Welcome to Double Take. This is Jake, joined by Matt as always. I am recording in my bathroom because I'm moving up to Utah in a couple weeks, so somebody's in my room where I was at, so I'm on the couch for a couple weeks. It's an interesting place to record, Matt. We'll see how the acoustics and the sound quality is when we're done.
Yeah, no, it's maybe a bit more echoey than usual, but not too bad. But think of it this way. This is one of our last regular podcast recordings, possibly ever. You know, I'm sure we'll have one or so every once in a while, but for the most part, we're just going to be in the same room, which is going to make it a little bit easier to communicate and not interrupt each other and whatnot.
I know, it is hard to record. Man, I realize we've been doing this over 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
That is a long time. Good for us.
I know, this is actually episode 100, Matt.
Look at that. 100, and what a good week for it to come on, since there's not a lot of sports to talk about. We can celebrate our 100th episode.
We literally have nothing to talk about. There's the women's lawsuit, not women in general, but the U.S. women's national team, that for the most part, that lawsuit kind of took a big step. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Also, the 1999 women's national team had some exciting news that we just saw right before we started recording. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And then we'll talk about some TV show stuff. I just finished Parks and Rec. Matt's in the middle of Community. There's a few TV stuff just because there's zero sports going on, basically. But so we'll talk about some of that stuff. But we wanted to start with the women's national team, in particular, them losing the lawsuit. And Matt, you correct me, but from my understanding, they won the part about travel accommodations, but the equal pay, which was the big part, the judge deemed that they weren't getting unequal pay, basically.
Yeah, so the argument, basically what it hinged on from the article that I read, is that it was a fair, but basic, so there were two things. A, the women, I believe, either had only made slightly less than the men, or even just slightly more than the men over the last, I believe it was either 2 to 4 years. Obviously, though, the women both went to and won the World Cup, so they got basically all of their earnings. Had the men gone to the World Cup, even if they lost all their games, they would have really made way, way more than the women. But the big thing was that the women agreed to a collective bargaining agreement that included medical insurance, dental insurance, those sorts of things. And it basically had higher kind of guaranteed money, but there were lower incentives and lower bonuses for winning games. And so the judge said, well, you picked a plan with less potential for you to earn money. Of course, what the women would rightly say is, well, when you offered us the same plan as the men, that sort of riskier plan where if you win the World Cup, you get just tons and tons of money, you offered us less incentives and less bonuses for the same performance standards that were offered to the men. And so we took this plan because those incentives weren't high enough for us to think it was worth the risk of not taking this kind of lower plan. So they felt kind of backed into a corner and forced to take the plan that would get everybody money because they weren't offered as good a plan as the men, basically.
So what's kind of the next step?
So it goes to a higher court. I'm not sure how high of a court it can go to. Obviously, I think that the right thing to do would just be for U.S. Soccer to give them a new collective bargaining agreement. I'm not sure when this expires. I'm concerned, though, that another judge, the higher up this goes, is just going to say this is a collective collective bargaining agreement that you did agree to, so you have to honor that. I think that what is really going to change things is when the next collective bargaining agreement comes up. Because then, you know, I think that it would be very, very difficult for U.S. soccer to offer the women a lower quality, lower paying plan than they've offered to the men. So I'm going to see. I know that it's really interesting to listen when we're Googling, but I remember I tried to look this up earlier and I couldn't find it, but let me just see. U.S. women's national team.
Yeah, because I've read a couple things, but just even any sport, collective bargaining agreement, it's honestly hard for me to get through it and all the legal stuff like that. So I saw, like, the key points, like, the women lost their main argument. But as far as, like, different court circuits and stuff like that, it's hard for me to follow through, if I'm being honest, which is why, where you come in.
Yeah. Right. So I just looked it up, and ESPN just posted an article, which is helpful. So the current deal for the women expires at the end of 2021, and that is a little bit tricky because that would, let's see, we had, okay, so that would be because the next, this 2020 would have been Summer Olympics. We had, okay, so that the collective bargaining agreement expires before the next Women's World Cup, which is going to be in 2023. Yes. So that is good for the women. They'll at least get that new deal. Absolutely, for sure. Even if they do lose all their lawsuits at the higher level, they'll get it before the next World Cup, which is really, really important. And that's ideal. Obviously, you'd like to see them win this lawsuit, kind of make, earn back some of the money that they've lost out on over the last two World Cups that they've won, especially because, you know, Abby Wambach obviously isn't sitting into that money. Carly Lloyd might not be at the next World Cup. Allie Krieger won't be either. Becky Sauerbrunn probably won't be. Alex Morgan probably won't be. So there's a lot of players losing out on a lot of money if they don't win this lawsuit. And I think that's what's for at stake. Because I think in the next, you know, 10 years that the women's national team is going to be fine and they are going to get equal pay, is just whether these women who have really been the ones fighting for equal pay and really pushing for it really hard are going to be able to get the money they deserve.
Yeah. So hopefully they win or get some sort of balance there. And one thing, Matt, you made me think of before we start talking about the Netflix movie regarding the 99 team is I'm cautiously optimistic about the U.S. men's team in 2026. 2022, not so much, but 2026, Pulisic will be in his mid-20s. They got some other young guys, specifically Gio Reyna, son of Claudio Reyna, is why I mentioned this specifically, who's at Dortmund right now. Is that fair to hope, though, for the U.S. team that by 2026 they can have a good showing, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the U.S. is going to be hosting that World Cup with Mexico and Canada, and the farther they go, the more games they're going to play in the United States. So that's certainly ideal. But, yeah, I think, and honestly, you know, as much as we complain, as much of the problems that the men's national team has had, I really think that not making it, you know, was sort of a fluke. Like, they really do, even with all the problems that they have that do need to be fixed, I really feel like they should have made it. So I would certainly feel confident about them making it. As far as them doing well, though, you're right. Christian Pulisic is going to be, that's going to be the best World Cup of his career. So that's going to be huge. And this, you know, generation about Christian Pulisic's age, I think, I don't know if it's going to be as good as the 2014 World Cup. It's probably going to be around that level talent wise. But then obviously being played in the United States is going to be a huge bonus.
The 14 team should have not lost to Belgium. That was a dumb loss.
Well, if they would have played Kyle Beckerman, then they wouldn't have. So,
I will say, the 2014 World Cup featured the 7-1 Germany win over Brazil, which is the best soccer game of all time. So, not the end of the world.
That was, you know, I'm actually, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to start rewatching the 2014 World Cup because, you know, like you said, the Belgium game was really, really great. The U.S. team, they had some really exciting games, even though they did lose in the first round. There was that John Brooks header to beat Ghana, which was really, really exciting. Chile beat Spain and was really close to beating Brazil. It was a really, really good game. You have James Rodriguez. So that World Cup, to me, was my favorite World Cup I've ever seen. So I think I'm going to have to go back and watch some of those games again.
Yeah, I you know what I recently watched, Matt, was the 2006, I think, Champions League final where Liverpool came back from 3-0 to beat AC Milan in penalty. Ooh,
that one I've never seen.
It was good. I honestly, because I realized a lot of the goals were really quick for Liverpool in the second half, so I knew the last like 40 minutes no one scored, so I did cheat and skip forward a little bit.
Nice. But
still a very good game. Soccer jerseys in the mid-2000s were very baggy.
Yeah, that was the... It's interesting, and this might be a topic for another episode, but I feel like 90s was really, really good. Like, that was probably the peak of jerseys across sports, because you see some really cool soccer jerseys from the 90s as well. Late 90s, first half of the 2000s, there's some pretty bad jerseys, and now I feel like we're starting to, you know, get better jerseys. We're tightening, even like the basketball jerseys are, you know, we've tightened them up a little bit. We've gone back to some of the color schemes and design aspects of the 90s, and so, but yeah, 2000s was not a good time for jerseys.
No, I forgot Xabi Alonso played for Liverpool. Flash, maybe not even knew that, honestly.
Right, yeah, I just, you know, thought he was a Barcelona guy.
Yeah, me too. Or I thought he was Real Madrid. Well, either way, the Bayern Munich now. But
right. Oh yeah, yeah. That was a Real Madrid kid. I'm thinking of Xavi. Is Barcelona?
Oh, he's Barcelona. Yeah, Xabi Alonso is Real Madrid. Great podcast material debating which Spanish soccer teams which Xavi's played for.
Yes, see, Xavi is with a V, and Xavi is the B, but in Spanish they're pronounced very similar, and so it is very confusing.
Those Barcelona teams obviously mess with, like, Xavi and Iniesta. Very fun to watch.
Yeah, I like those ones a lot more. That, and I didn't even like them a ton, but I just don't... I'm not thrilled about the Barcelona team right now. Like, obviously, they're very, very good, but the players are just kind of meh.
Yeah, Luis Suarez sucks, but I really like Antoine Griezmann. He's one of my favorite players, for whatever reason.
Yeah, I wish he would have stayed at Atletico. I've kind of adopted, like, Atletico, not really, but sort of if I have to cheer for a Spanish team, that's kind of who I cheer for, so... It's hard to say that I like Griezmann.
I'm a Valencia guy. I don't know why Griezmann doesn't play in France, because he's French, but he's been, like, almost all his career in Spain.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think Spain's a pretty cool place. Maybe he'll go and, like, you got to think at some point he'll play for PSG just because he's French, right?
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Yeah. Soccer teams, Matt. Newcastle United, I want to be on the record. I've supported them since, like, 2006. Their owner is worth 10 times as much as the owner of Manchester City. So, Newcastle United could get Griezmann, could get Kylian Mbappe. Who knows what we could get. But I just want to be on the record that I am not a bandwagon Newcastle fan.
It's true. He has been cheering for Newcastle for a long time.
Just very lucky that this owner, this Saudi oil guy worth $320 billion, decided to buy Newcastle for whatever reason.
Right. Good for you. You know, sometimes, really, that's just what you need, and that's the thing that you can't really control, is just who owns your team. So
that's unfortunate, but you're right. But Matt, I guess there's honestly not even much to talk about with the women's national team, but the 1999 team. But I literally just saw hiccups. Excuse me. I have the hiccups all the time. But right before we recorded this, I saw on Julie Foudy's Twitter page that Netflix is coming out with a documentary about that 1999 team and also the decade leading up to that with them and, like, following their lives and stuff. And I couldn't tell if it was a documentary or actresses, like a movie with actresses playing them. I think it's the second where the movie, like, it's actresses representing those players. But either way, very excited about it.
Oh, that would be see, I didn't read about it. I just assumed it was going to be a documentary. But
that's what I thought, but I'm blanking. Who made the penalty and took her jersey off?
Brandi Chastain.
Yeah, at the end of her thing, she was like, I wonder who's going to play us or what actors are going to portray us or something like that. That's why I think it's going to be actors and acted out.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it says a Netflix film, so.
Yeah. That's good. I think it'll be very good.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. Oh, that will be interesting. So, yeah, that was. I wish we would have been old enough to know what was going on with that.
We were 7 or so, I think.
Yeah, like just barely turning 7. So there was that. And, like, we don't really come from a soccer family. Like, we played soccer, but that was because our mom signed us up for everything. I don't think any of our older cousins played soccer. Some of the cousins our age played soccer, but nobody like older than us who we were trying to like imitate played soccer. So we kind of 2006. I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but 2006 was definitely when I started like feeling like I was watching soccer and became a fan. And I believe 2006 was the same year that Real Salt Lake was founded and had their first season.
Yeah, because it was about that time that Chris moved, one of our friends who's into soccer, like, he moved to our neighborhood, Salt Lake City got a soccer team, then the World Cup, that was the year Italy beat France in the final. Kind of all those factors is kind of what made our whole friend group kind of get into soccer.
Yeah, so shout out to Chris Ralstead for, he got us watching that World Cup. There was that one summer, either before 8th or 9th grade, where we played soccer at Bonneville, like, literally like 6 times a week.
Like, yeah, an absurd amount.
Yeah, it was a good time. Yeah. Maybe we'll get the, when you move back, we'll get the band back together when we decide it's, I mean, soccer's a better sport to play and not catch coronavirus. I feel it's not like the best one, but it's better than like football, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. And yeah, my ankle will be healed. I think I can like participate in stuff like that. Soccer will be weird, like actually kicking the ball, but
yeah, soccer might not be great for you now that I say it, but
yeah. Sorry. Sources calling me. Sorry about that. But Matt, let's again, not a lot of sports going on, which is why we're talking about our junior high soccer days and European soccer in 2006. But let's just wrap up. We got 10-15 minutes left with some shows we watched, because me and you were talking about this. What do you want to start with? There's 3 or 4 different things we want to talk about.
So I'll start with this, and this one I think will be a little bit quicker, but this is the best thing that has happened to me during quarantine. I feel like for those people who listen to the podcast but don't know us personally, they might not understand how obsessed I am with J.R.R. Tolkien and all of his writings. But on Friday, last Friday, I believe it was, Andy Serkis, who is the actor who plays Gollum and Smeagol, read the all of The Hobbit, which I really appreciated because I'm much more into the books and the actual author and the words than the movie. So the fact that he was actually reading it was nice. What was interesting is he didn't stop. So he started at 10 a.m. London time and finished at 9 p.m. London time, which for me was 3 a.m. Utah time and then 2 p.m. Utah time. So I did sleep. I didn't want to try to be you know, pretend teaching my class and respond to emails while I wasn't awake. And I had to be on a conference call with some other teachers, so I didn't want to, like, be groggy and not paying attention through that. So I wasn't able to hear the whole thing, but I was awake, you know, as the dwarves came and the unexpected party, and as they set off on the adventure. I woke up when Gandalf rescued the dwarves in the goblin caves. I woke up again when they were fighting the spider. So I guess he must have been talking louder during the battles. But then I woke up in the morning and I was awake when Smaug descended onto Lake Town, and I was awake for the rest of the journey through that. So, and it was great. It was really great. I thought he did a really good job with the songs, which people don't appreciate as much as they need to. I thought, yeah, his voices were good and not over exaggerated. So I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, I legitimately don't have a response other than I think it's a good book, and if I'm going to listen to someone, he'd be probably top 10 people to listen to read the book.
Yeah, he's definitely, and he's a really good narrator because he's a good actor. The one thing I will say is that I think a lot of people don't really respect The Hobbit as a book. Like, they think it's a good book, but they think that it's a good book for children. And it certainly is a good book for children, but I definitely think that it's a high literature in the highest form, in the way that it totally changes what you expect from a fairy tale. And I also think, like, it's kind of a tragedy if you read it and you're thinking about Thorin and the things that Bilbo learns about him. Like, that scene when Thorin is dying and Bilbo is just so sad, and Thorin is just realizing that he spent his entire life chasing after, you know, gold and trying to be a king and have power. And then he's just looking at this hobbit and he's like, I could have laughed and sung songs and ate food and I could have been happy all this time, and now I have to die. It's so, so sad. And people don't, they're just like, oh, it's a kid's book. It's not a kid's book. It's for adults and it's beautiful.
That is honest. This I do have a response to. That's honestly maybe, like the deepest analysis of Thorin's death in particular. And this is not where I thought the 100th episode of the podcast would be going.
Right.
But yeah. You're right. That is like depressing. I honestly have never looked or thought of it that deep or that way. Maybe I like. Is that realization, is that something that's talked about, or something you just kind of have to infer? Because I definitely might have skipped over that part of the book if that's in the book.
Well, if you click on my Twitter profile, you'll actually see there's a quote there. And it's one of my favorite quotes from Tolkien, but I'll pull it up right now so that I can read it. So some of that obviously was my analysis. But I believe this is if it's not the last thing that Thorin says before he dies, it's one of the last two or three things. But he says, if more of us valued food and cheer and song over hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. And so he is sort of admitting, like, and I think there is this sense in, you know, all of Tolkien's works that the hobbits are kind of, you know, ignorant to what's going on in the world, and that there is a need for war, and sometimes there is a need to protect those people who can't protect themselves. And, you know, obviously going and to the Lonely Mountain and fighting off the dragon so that they could bring back the dwarves who are working in these coal mines were obviously important. But I think he does realize that he hasn't been taking advantage of, you know, what's really important in life and what would really make him happy, because, you know, he's gotten to the end of this and he hasn't been able to enjoy the gold or the Arkenstone or being king or anything else. So I think he does realize that he's made a mistake, and he does feel very bad. If you remember, he almost throws Bilbo off of the top of the gate when he realizes that Bilbo's stolen the Arkenstone. And now, as he's it's sort of like, it's not exactly the same, but you know, in Black Panther, when Killmonger realizes that he's about to die and he's like, oh, I was in Wakanda this whole time and I never looked at the sun setting, and that was the whole reason that I've been doing all this stuff. For Thorin, I think, has a moment that's very, very similar to that.
Well, now I'm depressed at the Black Panther and the Hobbit.
Yeah. Black Panther, we won't talk about that because I haven't watched it recently, but in my mind, that's the best film, like, as far as like, and like an art form, I guess I would say. I think it's the best narrative art of all of the Marvel movies. It's my favorite. I understand why it's not other people's favorite, but it's definitely my favorite.
Yeah, the only Marvel movies I've seen Captain America 2 in Italian. I've seen Endgame on an airplane. And I've seen Black Panther in English. So I think it's my favorite, but also low bar to clear based on all the other movies I've seen.
Yeah, Endgame doesn't make a lot of sense without Infinity War.
No, I was so confused and tired. Because right before I went to North Carolina, so I remember either I landed or right when I met up with you at the airport, I just had so many questions about Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Matt, the other thing I just finished, literally yesterday, I finished Parks and Rec for the second time, but the first time was in like high school or college or something like that. I got like weirdly sentimental at the end of that, and I like... Even in Friday Night Lights, like, I'm obviously sad it's over, but I don't get, like, sentimental about it. But I was sentimental about, like, everybody moving away from Pawnee and stuff like that. It was weird.
Yeah, Parks and Rec is definitely, like, you sort of feel like you're part of a family. And even though it ends happy and you kind of end feeling like everybody's together, you feel like you're the one who sort of has to go away.
Yeah, I think it's a good ending. I know a lot of shows, like, it's hard to end it. I think Friday Night Lights is a good ending. And I think Parks and Rec is a great ending. I'm trying to think other shows. Like, I felt like I didn't hate or like The Office ending. It was just like, it was the end, so they created a way to end it, you know what I mean? But yeah. The ending of Parks and Rec, like, I had a lot of closure. Maybe that's what made it more sentimental, is I couldn't use my imagination. Like, that's what happened, then it's over, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought they did a really good job. I feel like everybody ended in very logical places. I liked, you know, and like, I thought what they did with Tom was really nice, how his idea, like, you think that Tom's bistro is going to work and that's going to be his thing, but then he has to fail, and he has to fail even a few more times before he gets this thing, and you realize, oh, well, this is probably going to fail too, but then he'll just come up with something else, and that's, you know, kind of who he is. So that was really good. I thought it was really good that they made Leslie governor and not president. Like, I feel like Leslie could become president, but I like that they didn't put that on us necessarily. Yeah, what happened to Ron was perfect. It was all great.
Yeah, I felt like the president, they kind of left it open because at Gary's funeral, they had, like, some people escorting her and Ben out. And she served two. So I guess in that sense, they didn't completely close it out. So I like that. It's like, oh, did she become president or not? I like that. I honestly like April and Andy's. Again, this is not where I thought the 100th episode, what we're going to be talking about, was character development. But April and Andy, I thought, like, April went from this weird, like, college intern kid, and Andy went from a literally homeless person to, like, especially April, but this, like, smart, intelligent, like, driven person, like, who moved to Washington, D.C., and had that awesome job at the foundation she worked for. I loved that. And same thing with Andy. He's still, like, an idiot the whole time, but I like that. There was almost a whole season where he's trying to become a cop, and he didn't get it. And he still had success, like, with Johnny Karate and the TV show, and then whatever he was doing in Washington, D.C. I thought that was cool, because it didn't, like, just... The reason I didn't like Harry Potter is just ended how he thought it was going to all the time. And Parks and Rec, it was happy, but it was different than what I thought it was going to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's very realistic, I think, is because people, you know, fail all the time. And I feel like with stories, people just try to tie them in these really perfect knots. And it's not necessarily like that. You know, like Leslie got not impeached, but recalled from the city council or whatever it is. So yeah, I think that failure is really, really important. And that's like not to come back to Lord of the Rings, but a lot of people don't like the way that the Lord of the Rings ends in the books, because in the books they come back and Saruman has taken over the Shire and they have to fight people out of the Shire. And the complaint that people have is that, oh, I thought it had just ended when we dropped the ring into the fire. That should just be the end. We shouldn't have to do this other stuff. But I think the point of that was, and what I'm pretty sure that's what he said the point was, but if not, I certainly think that the point is just to show that, you know, war and evil isn't necessarily over just because you've won the big battle. And Parks and Rec obviously had different themes, but I think it's showing like you're going to fail, but you can still succeed is a lot better message than just saying, oh, if you work hard, you're going to succeed. I think it's important that people see people coming out and finding some sort of a triumph after not, like, they don't get what they think they want, but then in the end, the characters all end up with what they actually do want, which is each other and family, and that they're together.
Yeah, not to go back to Andy and April, but when Andy was like, when he started becoming a cop, April, like, it started out as like a joke because April was nervous, so they were like joke writing about like they were gonna move and like get different jobs and stuff, and April realized for Andy all of his jobs were like security guard, cop, FBI agent, stuff like that. So that's why she's like looked at the list like, oh, you should become a cop. And that's why they went down that path. And then when April realized she didn't like her parts job, they started looking at like different jobs she might like. And then Andy realized, like, let's not list jobs, but let's list things you want in a job and find that job. So the idea that I feel like you were talking about, where, like, you can have success and happiness even if it's not what you pictured. So it's not doing something specifically, but it's, like, looking for those qualities and then fitting your life and, like, letting it kind of flow into those qualities or that happiness, what you're looking for, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, no, so as far as, you know, the character development, I think that does as well as any sitcom I've ever seen. And, you know, in addition to that, it's really funny. Like, there's some other sitcoms, like The Good Place, I feel like does some really interesting things, and it makes some really interesting creative choices, but I just don't think it's as funny as a lot of other shows. Like, Parks and Rec is really, really funny.
I think it's underrated. Everyone talks about it's just like a ripoff of The Office, but I think it's obviously like Greg Daniels is the producer creator for both of them, so they're going to be similar, and they have the same like interview TV show like mode, but I think they're different. Like, and I think they're pretty different, and I think Parks and Rec should get credit as its own independent, creative, funny show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think it's good, and I feel like, you know, all the characters on The Office are obviously really, really funny, but I feel like because there's less characters in Parks and Rec, they can develop a little bit more. They get a little bit more time to shine. And so I like the cast of Parks and Rec, I think, better. I think as a whole, I think that the cast is funnier. And obviously, you know, they've gone on to Chris Pratt and whatever April actress is, she's gone on to do really big things. Ron Swanson is obviously... Ron Swanson rivals Steve Carell in a way that I think surprised people a lot. And he's kind of... I know he's a side character. He's not... It's more about Leslie than Ron, so that parallel doesn't make sense. But Ron has some of the best one-liners in TV.
Yeah, I was talking with some other people because I wrote on Twitter that Billy Eichner was the funniest. I might be saying his name, but he was the funniest character in the show. Because he just, even though he's like a very side character, he just like has the most out loud moments for me. But obviously Ron's the character favorite in that. And I think it's because he's, I don't know, this is a simple view on it, but he's just so weird that it's funny.
Yeah. I know. He's weird, but he's absolutely believable. Like, you can totally see a person like that existing in real life.
I like character development, like Ron, like he ends up becoming a father and like getting a cell phone and, you know, having two little girls that are his stepdaughters, like, and he's still, like, on the exterior remains the same, but then he, like, becomes a father figure to April, especially Andy, his wife, takes Andy to the dentist. Like, he's someone who, like, doesn't change as much on the outside, but you can see as well, like, he goes through a lot of change and, like, development as well. And a lot of that had to do with, like, Diane and becoming a father.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my favorite character, actually, well, I don't know if he's my favorite character, but I really, really like Jean Ralphio, which kind of surprises me because I usually don't like characters like that.
He's someone who, like, he's so funny, but if one of the people, like, in real life, he'd be like, what is wrong with you?
Right. Well, I kind of think that's why he works, is because he's absolutely a terrible person. Like, he's probably the worst person in the series, but he's totally harmless because he's so inept at everything he does. I don't think we actually see him with a girl in the entire series. Like, if we did, I think we'd feel kind of gross, but we don't. None of his businesses ever succeed. So he doesn't actually achieve anything. And I think that makes it a lot more palatable.
Yeah, I think Ben Wyatt is one of the funniest characters.
Like, yeah, Ben is good.
Like, how just so many small things, like how he's obsessed with calzones the whole time, how he doesn't get Lil Sebastian the entire series. Like, it's all the little nerdy stuff he'll mutter that's like half of a sentence, and it's like not really a joke, but just like the way he says it is so funny. Like, yeah. I think he's underrated because he's not as like laugh out loud like Ron or Jean Ralphio or even Leslie with a lot of stuff, but he does so much, like has so many funny things that I think are hilarious.
Yeah, the low-cal calzone is one of my favorite jokes in the series.
Yeah, that is funny. I like Chris Traeger too. I thought he was funnier than I remembered him watching it again.
Yeah, no, he's good. I think he's the most one-dimensional of all the characters, but it definitely works. Like, I still really like him. I'm glad that he's there in the mix because the pairings that he has with, like, April and Ron, and really everybody, but those two in particular, I think work really, really well.
Yeah. Well, Matt, we talked about Parks and Rec and 2006 soccer longer than I thought we would. So let's talk about Community and wrap up the 100th show, unless there's anything else you want to talk about.
No, I think that's all I wanted to talk about. So the reason that we're talking about this, I finished Community recently. I think Community is the best sitcom in the history of television that I've watched. Obviously, I haven't gone back as far as some other people. But I love Community. It's absolutely my favorite show. And we can get to why. But I wanted to tell you and make this prediction out in the open so that if when it comes true that I can tell people that I told you so. I am about 85% sure that on Monday they will finally announce that they are going to make their movie, thus completing the 6 seasons in a movie.
On Monday specifically?
On Monday specifically. And the reason I think it's happening on Monday, well, there's a couple things. First off, it just came out on Netflix. So the show is more relevant than it has been in years. A lot more people are watching it. Joel McHale has said that it's more likely to happen now than ever. The Russos have said they think that it's more likely than not to happen. And they think that because the show's on Netflix, Netflix would be a good producer. Dan Harmon has said he's optimistic. Allison Brie has said she's gotten a call about a Community movie. But specifically Monday is they're going to do a table read of a lot of casts of sitcoms are reuniting to do table reads of their old episodes as fundraisers. Community is going to read the episode where Pierce has died and he's making everybody take the lie detector test before he gives them his bequeathals from his will, basically. And if you remember, that is the episode where we find out that Troy's leaving, because Pierce says, if you sail around the world with LeVar Burton, then I will give you all of my money that I have left, which is like $14 million or something. And the reason that I think it's significant they're doing that episode is because I've heard Dan Harmon say that if he ever did a Community movie, I've read two or three things, but one thing he said is that, like, maybe Troy is stranded on an island, or he's been captured by pirates or something, and the rest of the study group has to go rescue him. So I'm curious if they add on something to the end of the table read where they get a telegram from Troy or something, and they decide they're all going to go rescue him, and that leads into the movie.
Well, I would be ecstatic, and next Monday I will remember that you said / predicted that.
Okay, so you can hold me accountable for what happens.
That's an underrated show, Community. That got us through college. We watched a lot of Community in college.
Watched a lot of Community, and it's so funny. And it's basically, for those of you who don't watch Community, from the outside, it looks like a lot of satire and a lot of parody. So, like, they have one episode that is a spaghetti western that they do with paintballs. And they have another episode that's like a steampunk thing, but they're playing Hot Lava. And they have another episode that is kind of looks and sound like a Ken Burns documentary from PBS, like he would do on the Civil War. But it's on a pillow fight that they have throughout the whole school. And they just get in these crazy situations. But what I think is actually happening, and the reason, because, like, and Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've never watched an episode of Community and felt like, for however ridiculous the camera work and the actual events, it's never felt like something that wouldn't actually happen at the school, right?
Right.
And the reason that I think that is because I think they're using different genres and different tropes to tell a story. So, like, for example, there's an episode where somebody comes into the biology lab and pushes off a yam. They're growing a yam, and they push it off and before it's been able to sprout, and so they can't get a good grade, and so they have to do an investigation and have to prove to the biology teacher that somebody else did it so they can get their A. And they do it like a Law and Order episode. And you could say, oh, they just wanted to do a Law and Order episode, so they did this. What I think they're actually doing is they're saying, we want to tell sort of a mystery investigation kind of lawyer piece. Let's do it like Law and Order, because Law and Order tells those types of stories really well. I think they choose a style that fits whatever story that they're trying to tell. So anyway, that's probably more into theory. I'd like to maybe get into some of our more favorite episodes, but that is my pitch to Community as far as it being just the best storytelling I think that there is on television.
Yeah, that's the next thing. When you're done with it on Netflix, I'm going to watch it. I just don't want to screw up the episodes you're on. Plus, I have to finish my last season of Love Island Australia as well.
Oh, yes, that's very important.
It is. It's such a good show, but Grant is a douche. Anyway, you finished Community so I can watch it. Just finished Parks and Rec. So our 100th show, did not think we'd be talking about... This was the most intellectual show we've done, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to flex my English major muscles out. That was kind of fun. I'm sure we probably lost a few people, but yeah. I felt like I talked more in that second half than I usually do.
Probably won't be the most listened to show, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's okay. You know,
I thought it was fun.
It was fun. Yeah. Do you have a favorite episode of Community, Jake, or one that comes to mind?
You know, the spaghetti western one / the Star Wars paintball ones you talked about is obviously hilarious.
Classics.
Where Abed, I forgot in the context, but where Jeff is roommates with Abed, and then Abed starts forgetting movie stuff. That has my favorite line in the series. That might be my favorite.
That's a good one. Okay, sorry. This is the last thing I want to say about Community. But my favorite joke of all time, it's in one of the, like a cold open, I guess. But they're looking through the course catalog and trying to think what class to take. And I think Shirley says, oh, look, they have a class on telling jokes. And then Annie says, oh, don't take that. I dropped it after the lesson on setups. The professor is so old. And then that's the end of the joke. And the first couple times you watch it, you just don't understand what's happened. But it's so like the third or fourth time I'd watch it, I realized, oh, she dropped the class after setups. So she never learned how to tell a punchline. So she told the setup to the joke, but then she didn't actually tell the joke. And like that to me is the funniest comedy, when people do something that looks, that works because it looks like it doesn't work, even though they know that some people aren't going to get it.
See, that's why this probably isn't actually that great of a pitch for like English or like humanities. There's a lot of jokes I get on sitcoms from humanities classes, but like just taking those classes in college, again, this probably isn't the best pitch for taking those classes if this is the best benefit of it. But there's so much stuff on like TV and literature and just society that you get because of like those English classes, because of humanity classes, like those types of classes in college. Like there's a Modern Family joke about hubris that I wouldn't even know the word. It's like a Greek word for pride, unless I would have taken humanities. But because I did, Phil, I don't even remember the joke, but I remember Phil said it and I was like dying laughing. And the person I was watching it with had no idea what I was talking about.
Well, Jake, let me bring it back to the beginning, because I think if Thorin were alive in our time or had died in our time, I think he might have said something like, if more of us valued good jokes on sitcoms over hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. So I think that your pitch for humanities makes lots of sense, because what you're saying is if you major in the humanities, you will enjoy television more, and that's more important than hoarded gold or whatever your accounting job is.
Again, did not think this is how the 100th episode would go, but I'm happy with it and pleased with it. Thought it was fun. Good conversation.
Yeah. It was a good time, yeah. Yeah, and that was, but yeah, just on the 100th episode, it's cool that we've been able to do this and that people have actually listened. I've been surprised by the amount of people that have listened. So if you've stayed on to the end, especially since we haven't been talking about sports, appreciate you staying on for this episode and all the episodes that we've done.
Yeah, especially this show. No, this is like the most, because I live in Arizona, so I'm excited to move back to Utah, but like the only time me and you talk consistently, you know, for we've been doing this a little over 2 years, so it's been fun to do that. And yeah, I agree. It's been fun. I love when people tell me like, oh, I love the show, or listen to the show, both people I know and random people as well. It's been a pleasure. So shout out to all listeners. Appreciate it. It's going to get a little better in a few weeks because Matt and I will be in the same place. So we're excited. I was going through after Carl Bombardier and Matt Brown came on the last two episodes we did. I was editing the website, mjdoubletake.com, to update those to his guests. And we've talked to a bunch of cool people, Matt.
We have, yeah. We'll have to see who else we can get. But we've had, you know, really good luck getting people on and had some good, yeah. If you do need things to listen to, and obviously, you know, the sports stuff isn't going to be too up to date, but for the most part, I don't think any of the interviews that we have are very time dependent. So like, I thought the conversation we had with the swimmer at Harvard was really, really interesting. The nutrition one was obviously really recent, but I think Sarah Chafee, we talked a little bit about sports psychology and that was really interesting. So there's some good interviews in the archives if you're looking for something to listen to.
Yeah, no, she was, I think, the first interview we did. Patrice Renee, the cornerback from North Carolina. Some of that was football time, but a lot of it was some of it was him growing up in Haiti, then Canada, then moving to the United States to play football. So that was the coolest story, I think. We were right. Maddie Harrison, the swimmer from Harvard, was really interesting to talk to. Honestly, any of the interviews, I think, are really good. Just cool hearing. They've been, like, so different as well, which is fun.
Yeah, no, we've got interesting. And I think the kinds of people that maybe don't get interviewed on other sports podcasts. So I think that's another interesting Harvard thing we've been able to do.
Texas Tech dietitians aren't getting interviewed a whole lot. So I think it's actually cool getting a different view instead of hearing. Obviously, I'd love to talk to Joe Burrow, but like he's getting interviewed all the time. You know what I mean? So it is cool still to get different perspectives from different people and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Matt, it's been a great 100. Cheers. I will be live from my bathroom next week. Hopefully some sports happen. Otherwise, we're going to get in some more plot summaries, some more character development stuff, maybe some themes conversations.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, I mean, and if I had all that to say about The Hobbit, just wait till I get started on The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, so hopefully... I actually like talking about that. Maybe we'll just turn it into a literature podcast during quarantine.
Yeah, we'll do a, hey, Bomani Jones' book club. Maybe we can do a book club.
That's actually not a bad idea, Matt. That's not a bad idea. We'll see. Maybe we'll do like once a month. We do like a book club thing.
Yeah, I'd be into that.
We'll brainstorm. Let us know if you have any ideas. That would actually help me read. You know what we should do, Matt, is I know we've been ending the show for like 7 minutes, but... I was going to ask you what you're reading right now. I'm reading the book you got me for Christmas, the Kobe Bryant book. So cool. So interesting. Like it's not like a book, like a narrative, but it's just like wise words of wisdom from Kobe, basically.
Yeah. That one I'm going to have to borrow from you when you move back. That I think is going to be more interesting than what I'm reading right now. So actually, the book that I just read, I'll tell you a little bit about that. It's called The House on Mango Street. It's about a Latin American family growing, or a girl in a Latin American family growing up in a poor neighborhood in Chicago. And it's not really a typical story. It's like it's written in prose, but it for me, I read them more like a collection of prose poems, and you put them all together, and it sort of turns into a story about how she just... interacts with the world around her and the things that happen and the challenges that people have and her aspirations to leave Mango Street in that poverty, but also still stay connected to it. That book was really, really good. I enjoyed it a lot by Sandra Cisneros. The one I'm reading right now is called The Worm Ouroboros. Worm in Old English was another word for dragon. And I picked it because it's one of the first, fairy tales are a little bit different than fantasy for reasons I won't really get into. This is a book that was one of the only fantasies before The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis liked it a lot. J.R.R. Tolkien liked it, but not quite as much as Lewis did. It's really weird. It's about it's basically some adventures that demons have in hell, basically, and they have to go to war against the witches and the goblins and imps and pixies are there. And what's weird about it is I'm not 100% sure who to cheer for. Like, the demons seem to be the point of view characters, and they seem to be, you know, kind and noble, so I'm pretty sure they're the good guys, but I also feel like I'm gonna get to the end of the book and they're gonna do something bad, and it's like, and they were the bad guys all along, but I won't be surprised because they're called the demons. So I'm having a little bit harder time getting into it than some of the other books I've read, but I'm gonna finish it anyway, and we'll see where we go from there.
Let me know, Matt. I just want to close with my favorite line so far from Kobe's book. There was a whole page where the only text, it was talking about like playing left-handed and how he learned to play left-handed. The only text on the whole page was, "God gave us two hands."
That's amazing.
We could have a show, Matt, just on Kobe Bryant and Bryant quotes. I think... he's, between the both of us, I think, our most interesting athlete between the two of us combined, probably.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, if you would have asked me, you know, which professional athlete I want to have, you know, a dinner or lunch with, basically have a conversation with, it would absolutely be Kobe. And, like, you know, I obviously, you know, I'm a bigger fan of, you know, Nick Raimondo or Rudy Gobert, Donovan Mitchell. or a lot of other guys, but Kobe's absolutely the most interesting. I mean, even like Michael Jordan said some really interesting things, but God gave us two hands. Like, that's a poem. That's amazing.
Like, isn't it so simple, though? Like, it's so simple, but I read it, I was like, holy crap, no one thinks like that. Like, what is wrong with you? But it's also, like, the simplest thing anyone could say.
Yeah. You know, okay, here's what we're doing for our book club. I want to finish this book first, so we won't maybe start it for 3 weeks or a month. We'll get you moved back in. But let's read the fantasy books that Kobe Bryant, he didn't write them, but he came up with the concepts and the magic systems and the laws and that sort of thing, and then had other people help him write them. Let's do those.
All right, we'll figure out a book club system. It'll especially be easier when I get back. We'll figure out a book club system and get everybody reading along. So, all right, I think we're finally going to end the episode.
Yeah, I think I'm good to go.
All right. That's been fun. It's one of the fun, it's not the most sports detailed, but one of the funnest ones. So great way to celebrate 100. Appreciate everybody listening. And we will talk to y'all next week.